Shakespeare's Globe has become an established part of the London theatre scene over the past 15 years and more. Indeed, it's just been named London Theatre of the Year for 2012 by the Stage newspaper and received a Special Critics Circle Award for the groundbreaking international season of Shakespeare's plays performed in 37 languages last summer here. But a new chapter in the modern Globe's history is about to begin, as the Sam Wanamaker Indoor Theatre is prepared for performances in 2014. With me, Heather Neal, is Dr. Farah Karim Cooper, Head of Research at Shakespeare's Globe, to give Theatre Voice some insight into the very different processes entailed in mounting productions in indoor Renaissance theatres. Well, welcome, Farah, and thank you for talking to Theatre Voice. You've written about cosmetics in Shakespearean theatre, and that was published by the University of Edinburgh, and co-edited Shakespeare's Theatres and the Effects of Performance, published recently by Arden. Well, as the Sam Wanamaker gets ready downstairs, not very far from where we are, and the shell's been there for some time, I don't think people always realise that the outside of it's been there ever since this theatre opened, but the inside's now being put in place. So let's remind ourselves about the differences, the obvious difference between indoor and outdoor playing, the lack of daylight, and what difference that made then and now, because we're hoping to go back to candlelight, aren't we?
Yes. I guess there are two major differences. The one is obviously the way in which the theatre's lit. Yes. In the amphitheatres, it's lit by daylight. The indoor theatres are lit generally with artificial lighting, which is, in that period, candles. We're hoping to replicate that practice. Indoor theatres at that time also had daylight streaming in through quite large windows, depending on what indoor theatre you're talking about. So the Blackfriars would have had sort of parliamentary hall, cloistered windows.
And are we thinking mainly about Blackfriars?
Blackfriars is what I've often said is sort of ghosting this project. Because we can't reconstruct a Blackfriars, and because we have a shell, which is based on drawings of the 17th century theatre that can't really be identified. What we're doing is we're speculating through rigorous research about what an archetype of a Jacobean theatre might have looked like. Mm. So if we were Jacobeans and we were building an indoor playhouse, what materials would we have at our disposal? What would it have looked like? What would it have sounded like? Using the outdoor amphitheatre is a really good way of thinking about it as well, because the other major difference is the size. Mm. The amphitheatres were large playhouses. In Shakespeare's time, they would seat and stand anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000 people. At the Globe now, we can take 1,500 people. Shakespeare's Blackfriars Theatre only had 600 seats. Mm. And so you can see already the huge difference that might have on performance and the kinds of plays that you would see there.
Mm-hmm. The Blackfriars was part of a monastery, wasn't it, to start with? It wasn't a purpose-built theatre to begin with, was it?
That's right. It was a found space, as it were, once the monasteries had been dissolved. The Blackfriars had gone into private hands, and there was a particular... the hall, the parliamentary hall, which is actually the place where, I believe, Catherine of Aragon's divorce took place, was fitted out by James Burbage in 1596. Yes.
And Henry VIII, the play, might have been put on there very same space.
Indeed, and if it wasn't, then it was pointing to their playhouse over the Blackfriars.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the open air theatre, of course, does have some effects, doesn't it? You can make sounds, thunder, and there was a cannon. We know about the cannon because it set the theatre alight when it went off. In 1613, wasn't it?
1613, yes.
So we're at the anniversary this year.
We better be careful this year.
But what else could you do? I mean, obviously music, but did they use cosmetics? Presumably they did to change the boys into women.
They did. There's a wide range of effects that they had. I mean, these new amphitheatres in the 1570s, 80s, and 90s were sort of technological machines almost. When you think about if 1599 was the year that Julius Caesar was written, it was also the year the Globe was built. It was the first storm staged by Shakespeare. So they had sound effects. They also had smell effects. So the smell of dung might have sort of permeated the air if they were setting off fireworks, for example. They use squibs to create lightning and to introduce the devils onto the stage. The traps on the stage and in the ceiling also provided technologies for them. And then there were the technologies of the body. So body parts made of wax and stage blood was also a really useful effect, and the use of cosmetics. And sometimes the same materials were used for all of them. But cosmetics were used definitely for portraying femininity, but also you could use makeup to play ghosts or to play a fool. A fool might have his face painted, or even a wall, as Shakespeare says in Midsummer Night's Dream.
But the paint they used was actual paint sometimes, wasn't it? I mean,
it was the same material that they would have used to paint canvases, which is why they called it face painting and why they talked about pencils, which as we know now are paintbrushes, when they talked about women using makeup, which was it was a concoction of white lead and vinegar. And it was very popular because it created a quite beautiful pigment effect. And but there are wide range of other materials, but that was really the base foundation that they would use. And obviously it was poisonous. But
and what was the blood made from? Was that paint as well?
There's a lot of theories about blood. There, paint was definitely used for blood. Some people think wine. Some people actually argue pig's blood, pig's bladders squeezed on stage.
Yes, because there would have been bear baiting in the vicinity as well. There might have been quite a lot of blood about.
Yes, indeed. A colleague who's done lots of work on early modern animals says that butchery happened in the streets in London. So, you know, lots of animal blood running through the streets, I imagine.
Yes. Smells? Did they really need to make smells?
Probably not. Yeah.
But then when they moved indoors... it was much more intimate and probably much more smelly for other reasons as well, I should imagine. But what difference did that make to the makeup?
Indoors, you're much closer proximity, for one thing, and you are lit by candles. So that means that it's going to be a lot darker than it is in the amphitheaters. Mm. So you need somehow to enhance your face or emphasize the face, because the face is really the actor's primary gestural tool. Mm. And so they would have used kind of sparkly material, like pearl, which we know was used in the 17th century. The actors may not have been able to afford real crushed pearl, but they might have used oyster shells or other forms of faux pearl that were around at the time. Egg whites were sometimes used to create sheen on the face. So it's that kind of thing that you would need to have some shine or glisten to the face so that the candles pick up that glisten. And it's quite stunning, actually.
I have to ask you the modern question about health and safety, about candlelight. Is that going to be possible? Because it's a small... wooden structure, at least the interior is wooden, isn't it?
Yes. I think, frankly, Sam Wanamaker probably had a harder time trying to convince the London Fire Department that he wanted to use thatch in the globe. They did, as you know, lots of exhaustive tests on the wood at the time. I guess in flame, you know, it was on fire for ages and it still didn't burn. So, I think we have quite a few years of precedent and relationship. Early on in the project, we got the fire department involved so that they would be aware of why we want to use candles, what the effects might be. We have an expert on early modern lighting on our architecture research group who's been instrumental in that process, Martin White. We've done experiments with them as well, which have also reassured them. We also have to build things into the theater space as well, like emergency lighting and the usual things that modern buildings require. I think that in itself is giving us a lot of security and certainly making the fire department feel more secure.
But the candles themselves could be made from different materials, couldn't they?
Yes. The two main materials that we've been looking at are tallow and wax. And obviously tallow burns much more quickly, and they're quite greasy when you touch them. Your hands smell like meat. And the wax candles obviously burn, take a lot longer to burn, so they're probably more economical. But I believe in the 16th and 17th century, Martin White would be able to correct me on this, that tallow was less expensive, and so it was probably the more common.
Was it smokier as well, though?
Apparently. I mean, we have references to it being smoky, and certainly that's what Martin, when he first did his experiment in Bristol with these candles, that's what he expected, but was actually pleasantly surprised that it wasn't as smoky and smelly as he thought it was going to be.
It's going to be a very enclosed space, and the audience will be sitting in quite a different way from what they're used to at the Globe, in that they'll be much closer together, won't they?
They will. They'll be sitting much closer together. We probably only have capacity for about 350, between 320 and 350. The stage is smaller. We have seating all around the stage, so behind the stage on the Franz Gallery, and also to the side there'll be boxes, which we'll be calling the gentlemen's boxes.
People actually on the stage, because they used to sit on the stage, didn't they?
Yes. I'm not sure. It's up to the directors individually if they want to use stools for people to sit on the stage, but it's a much smaller stage than the Blackfriars was. So it may not be feasible, but it actually... When you look at references back then, the actors were still quite put out, and they do talk about give us some room to do our show type thing. So it's not unlikely that it was cumbersome back then, regardless of the size difference. So the audience will be wrapped around the actors, and then in the pit there's the Worcester College drawings, which is forming this sort of spatial map for the auditorium. Show seating that's pit seating that's curved. Towards each other, which is actually very strange.
Yes, people will be looking at each other instead of at the stage.
Yeah.
Or they could be if
they could
this
be.
Was followed.
Yeah. And so we're going to experiment with that because I don't know if that's what the seating was like in the Blackfriars. Yeah. Ben Johnson does talk about curves and wedges, so maybe that's what he's referring to.
But no standards.
No standards. Well, they'll be standing in the upper galleries along the top,
right.
Which actually you would have had in the Blackfriars as well, in the 12-penny rooms. People might have stood. So that will be the only standing, but there won't be any standing in the pit.
Yes, I've been to see Peter McCurdy, who's in charge of building the interior, and seen some of the experiments about sight lines, because it's quite difficult to get a good view from some of the places, isn't it? Or at least, obviously, everyone's going to make an effort to make sure people do get a good view, but if you follow the obvious drawings, it's not always easy to see the stage without building up an area for people to stand on at the back.
That's true. And actually, being able to include those standing areas has improved sight lines immensely, and I think it's going to be wonderful. And if there are moments of the play that you can't see, moments during the performance that you can't see, there'll be other moments you can where people can't see. It's like that in the Globe as well. And I think early modern theatre was written around that kind of visual condition, that sometimes somebody would faint on stage and somebody will say, "She's fainted." And it could be for the part of the audience that couldn't see it. And certainly, if you were sitting in the Lord's Rooms at the Globe, which is just above the Discovery Space on the Franz Gallery, you wouldn't have seen half of what's going on in the Discovery Space. So
you would have been seen.
But you would have been seen, exactly,
But are the sections of the new theatre going to be similar in that you have the heavens and the earth, which is the stage, and hell beneath, which is the trap door going into it?
Yes.
Those three areas are still similar, aren't
they? They're still similar. We don't have a stage roof and pillars, obviously, but we do have a ceiling, and we're hoping that it'll be a painted ceiling. So there'll be some hopeful painted reference to heavens at some point somewhere. We haven't completely decided on what the decorative scheme's going to be inside, but we know that it will be painted, and we've held a seminar with some interiors experts from around England, and they've advised us that painting it quite sumptuously might not be a bad idea. So we're still trying to work that one out. And yes, there'll be a trap in the ceiling, and there'll be a trap on the stage, so that you can use the same kinds of machinery that were used in the outdoor amphitheaters.
Yeah. Yes, some plays will have been seen first outdoors and then taken indoors and presumably adapted. Macbeth is one, because we've only got the 1623 text of that, haven't we? So we don't know if it was changed, I suppose.
We don't. I mean, I'm not a textual scholar, but I think there'll be a lot of people who'd be able to say that they could see what additions that someone like Thomas Middleton made to the text. And we do have an account of its performance at the Globe in 1611 from Simon Forman, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, I imagine once Shakespeare's company had a hold of the Black Friars, that whatever was in his repertory was moving in between both spaces.
Yeah. And did they play all through the winter?
That's the current understanding, that the Black Friars was used as their winter playhouse, and then they used the Globe in the summer.
It was more expensive, wasn't it? Because were they not called the private theatre? So whereas the amphitheatre were the public ones.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, they were. For example, to get in the door at the Globe, to stand in the yard, you'd pay a penny. To get in the door of the Blackfriars, you pay sixpence. So it's already kind of established who's going to see plays there.
Yes. Yes. Well, the people who go there, presumably, will be more finely dressed, won't they? At least the ones who are... in the main audience, presumably some of them would have been in the Globe as well, but
yes,
you'd have had to look across the groundlings, who would probably be rather scruffier. But the sense of what it was like to be inside an indoor theatre must have been rather more glamorous.
Yes, it was almost, I guess, a kind of version of a court audience, almost. And certainly there's a lot of satirical drama in the Jacobean and Caroline period about people like acting like peacocks and going in there to show off their feathers, as it were. And certainly Ben Jonson likes to have a go at people for that reason. And many people, including my former PhD student Sarah, have talked about these indoor theaters as being sort of engines of fashion, which is a really lovely phrase. Not mine, but it's a nice way to characterize it, because you would have seen sort of the latest fashions. These were the wealthiest people in the city, and they would come in and show off their clothing, their hairstyles. It was quite trendy.
Yeah. Well, what effect did this have on what appeared on stage? Were the costumes very different from what you would have seen in the outdoor theatre?
Probably not. I mean, most acting companies have a certain amount of money, and they certainly wouldn't have necessarily had the same amount of money as a nobleman coming in, but they would have had very nice costumes. We know from Henslowe's diary that they did pay a pretty penny for their costumes.
They were very expensive, weren't they?
Yeah.
Compared with what someone would earn.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. But they were the sort of a prize, in addition to the play script, they were the prize commodity of a theatre company in that period. The colors that work in an outdoor amphitheater don't necessarily work in an indoor theater that's lit with candles. And millions of critics have, not millions, but lots of them have cited Francis Bacon's, description of what colors look best indoors when you're playing a mask. So you get sea green and carnation and that kind of thing, and spangs or spangles, which are sequins, basically. Mm. You need to glitter
to catch
in
the light.
There. Yeah, yeah. And that would have had quite a beautiful effect, I imagine.
Yes. Well, there were things, obviously, you could do, which you could have done outside. And so we have The Tempest, for instance, really perhaps should be seen indoors, should it?
Yeah, but the beauty of that play and most of Shakespeare's other plays is that it works in a different but equally magical way outdoors. You know, having seen it at the Globe here a couple of times, it can be as mesmerizing. I'm sure indoors it would have had a sort of more subtle quality, and particularly there's a lot of music deployed in that play, a lot of song, which makes some statement towards the indoor theaters and the acoustic in there. And certainly scholars like Andrew Gurr think that that it was the first play written that Shakespeare wrote for the Blackfriars.
Uh-huh. And magical things can happen, disappearances, for instance. I mean, we had disappearances in Macbeth, of course, and appearances, the apparitions, but these could be done much more easily and with more effect, couldn't they?
It depends. I mean, I'm not sure about easily, in that you will be, as I said, sort of audience on all sides of you, it's harder to pull off stuff. But I think with the early modern mindset about what theater was that it was a dialogue or dialogic, and that you would have to, the audience has to bring its, you kind of sign a contract with the actors that you know, when Oberon says, I'm invisible, the audience has to go, oh, yes, you are.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing that it's, I'm going to quote Andy again, but he calls it implausible illusion, which is sort of what early modern theater was built
yeah.
on. And the audience has to completely sort of sign up to that.
Yes. But still, there was more spectacle, though, wasn't
yes,
there? The mask was given more
absolutely.
Free rein.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a very visual space. It was a space that would exploit spectacle, of course. But I've always been a kind of multi-sensory scholar, in that I believe that the amphitheaters are not given over to one sense or another. It's multi-sensory, and that you would see spectacle in the outdoor amphitheaters as well as the indoor theaters. It was just of a different nature. It had a very different visual, dynamic in that space. So you would have to deploy different types of spectacle, I imagine. So smaller props and focusing attention on one thing, like the mole in Cymbeline. On can't remember her name now.
Imogen.
You know, drawing attention to
very
one thing.
Small thing.
Yeah. I think there's a lot more of that sort of optical work happening in the indoor repertory.
Yes. Well, it sounds very exciting. What about sound? You could obviously you wouldn't have a cannon indoors, but you can, as you say, have music.
Yeah.
But would you still have thunder, presumably? What sort of thunder machines would they have?
Well, again, my PhD student, Sarah Dustagir, who's no longer my PhD student, Dr. Dustagir, she says she did a lot of work on that, comparing the aural and visual effects of the Blackfriars repertory with the Globe repertory. Mm. And you get a lot more sort of booming sounds in the Globe. You get clocks striking, you get thunder, you get owls screeching and things like that. But in the Blackfriars repertory, the sounds are more subtle, they're softer, they're designed to work within the particular architecture, the acoustic that was created by that architecture. So you see a lot more music in the Blackfriars repertory.
Is that instrumental or singing, or mostly singing?
A lot of singing, instrumental too, but different instruments. So probably more string instruments in the indoor theaters. So it's not that one theater or the other gives itself over entirely to one sense.
Mm.
It's that they have to be deployed differently.
Mm. So the texts might have been different. I suppose they would include some things in one for one space and leave them out for another.
Yeah,
maybe.
Possibly. Mm. But also, you know, the texts don't necessarily tell us exactly what the performance was. And so
there might have been performance texts, which are not the same as the reading texts.
Exactly. I imagine there's a lot of improvisation happening on the spot when they're rehearsing and they're adapting plays for indoors or outdoors, and all of that has gone silent now, obviously.
Yeah, sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about clowning? Does it make any difference to that? Obviously, there's less room for physicality.
Yeah.
Does it have to depend more on words? Well, it depended quite a lot on wit anyway.
Yes, I think wit becomes quite crucial, banter. If you look at sort of the Jacobean repertory, it is very internalized, it's very domestic. And this is another thing that Sarah looked at. It's a very different kind of focus. You know, on the Globe stage, you get lots of battles and you get lots of epic drama. Mm. And in the indoor theaters, you get quiet, domestic plays that emphasize women a lot. And the objectification of women.
We're talking about contemporaries of Shakespeare mainly,
Shakespeare himself. Yeah, contemporaries like Webster, for example.
Although even in The Winter's Tale, you get quite a lot of small
Absolutely.
Scenes, don't you?
That play, for me, feels as though it was mapped directly onto the indoor space because of the way in which the light would have worked through the course of the performance. You would have had a lot more light when the play starts at sort of 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the winter, and as the plays moving, then the light is changing and going down. And I feel like this is all instinctive, but it appears to me that Shakespeare is sort of is writing along the light, if that makes sense. So by the time, you know, you have these wonderful pastoral scenes in the middle, it must be quite bright at that point because you've got daylight as well as the candlelight.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time you get to Hermione's statue coming to life, that's supposed to be a sort of miraculous moment. It's something we're all supposed to buy into, even though, you know, we can see clearly that she's a person.
Yeah.
It's the magic around that moment that requires intimacy, quiet, mystery, candlelight, spectacle.
Yeah.
And everybody is focused, and I have talked about this before, that the language of that scene is all visual. It talks about looking and marking and beholding. You see loads of references in that scene. And so the whole audience is meant to, you know, sort of land its gaze upon this statue. And surely it's lit with candles. And then she comes to life. And I think that would have been quite a special moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, will there be any daylight coming in to the new theatre at the Globe?
Yes, I mean, we do have windows, but also we will have light boxes in the corridors, and we're working very hard on that to make sure that the light is warm and that it's it does replicate daylight in some way. The corridors will be sort of modern corridors.
Mm-hmm. And will the audience be lit? Was the audience lit then? Did the candles go all the way round the interior?
Yes, I mean, we're still trying to work out how many candles will be in the space, but there would have been sconces on the walls as well around the auditorium.
Yeah.
So the audience would have been lit as perhaps more focus on the actors, but they would have been lit as well. That was the kind of early modern fashion to be in equal lighting.
Yes.
Or at least to have your audience visible to you.
So part of the spectacle was the audience.
Absolutely. The audience were absolutely part of the spectacle. Mm. And at the Blackfriars, if you've got audience sitting on stage as well, then you've got this really interesting intermingling of the two. They were the decoration to some extent with all of their expensive clothes and their feathers and hats and swords and wigs and pearls. And
yes. It'd be interesting to know if going to the theatre changed fashion or influenced it at all.
Yes, I mean, it's hard to know, but it's probably a bit like Hollywood today, I imagine,
yes.
Where, you know, you see somebody wearing something, they set a trend, and then that kind of spreads around. I mean, I think
Their clothes would have had to last, wouldn't they, because they used to be passed down from generation to generation, didn't they?
Yes, or servants would inherit clothing as well.
Yeah. Which is one way actors got them,
isn't
it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Because can you give any idea about how much, say, a doublet and hose would cost compared with, say, what a cobbler would earn or someone like that?
I don't have those. I never memorize.
But it's many times more,
isn't it? Yeah, it is a lot more. It is a lot more. And especially when it depends on what materials that doublet and hose are made of,
of course.
And does it have velvet? Is the velvet 3-plied? You know, it's very, very variable, but expensive nonetheless.
Yes.
Some people say that it's the equivalent to what you would spend on a house or a car nowadays, what people spend on their wardrobes.
Yeah.
I don't know what the nature of that comment is, but it gives you an idea.
Yes. Well, they didn't very often make much of an effort to show period, did they? Or sometimes they did. We think, don't we, that they maybe had bits of togas on top of Elizabethan dress, say, in Julius Caesar.
I think so. I think they would have gestured towards a period rather than try to replicate it because they just, you know, especially the touring companies and the early Elizabethan companies, we wouldn't necessarily have had all the resources to do that.
Mm.
But yes, and also Elizabethan Jacobean culture are very, very symbolic in nature, and, you know, they understand symbols and read them quite.
Yes, some of which we've lost, of course.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the sumptuary rules. That's interesting. What people were allowed to wear on stage.
Yes.
Because you could get into terrible trouble for wearing even the wrong colour, couldn't you?
You could. I mean, there were laws that were around during the Tudor period, which stipulated what you could wear according to your social class. And so there were certain colors and materials that were just not available to you if you were of the working classes.
Even if you could afford them.
Exactly. Mm. So obviously this had complications for acting companies because they would have worn all of those things, especially if they had bought them from servants who inherited them from aristocrats. I think the stipulation was that they were not able to move outside of the theater in those clothes. Mm. Within the theater, they would be okay if they were on stage because it was understood that they were performing.
Yes, so royal purple indoors but not
yes,
outside.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Farah. I'm sure we'll come back to this when the theatre's ready for performance.
No
thank
problem.
You very much.
Sure.